Almandine bursts out, clearly distraught. Ismi holds open the robe, averting her eyes out of politeness, the way Aurora taught her to do. Lady Almandine stands up with a dripping swoosh and slides her arms into the robe's sleeves. Ismi can feel how disturbingly thin the fairy is, all muscle and bone, and how she seems to shudder with cold. "I should have known," the fairy repeats more quietly. "She always wanted what Daisy had." "Who's Daisy?" "It's what she called her sister. You look a bit like her. Your face, your..." She trails off. "Whose sister?" "Malfleur's, of course," the fairy practically spits. "They're silly flower nicknames. But she was too jealous, always too jealous of Belcur. Belcur, who could make even the pestilent vines that pesk the forest and stung our ankles bloom with sweet blossoms. Malfleur couldn't stand it." Almandine grabs Isby's wrist with slender, clammy fingers. Isby's pulse races. "I should have known, after what Belcur did to her." "Let me build you a fire," Ismi says, thinking quickly, hoping to urge Almandine on. The woman is clearly rattled, but Ismi is desperate to hear more. Belcur, kind, beautiful, the envy of Malfleur. It runs against everything she's ever heard about the famous fairy twins. If she offers further service to the fairy, perhaps the lady will spill more details. "You are too cold." "Am I?" she murmurs. "I hadn't noticed. It doesn't matter. I should have..." Her listlessness unnerves Ismi. "No wonder her sister stayed in Somay. I would have too. I should have known." That last utterance, a stone plunked into a pool, its weight subsumed and silenced by the water. "Known? What Malfleur wanted? What she took? What she'll take from all of us?" She leans closer to Ismi. "All of us," she hisses. Ismi shivers. She fears the woman may topple over and die in her presence. She sounds so weak, her teeth are beginning to chatter. "What is Somay?" Without thinking, Ismi places a reassuring hand on the fairy's arm. "Don't!" Almandine screams. Her scream turns into a hacking cry. "Don't touch me! Don't ever touch me! I can't take it! I can't!" The woman is racked with dry, choking heaves. Ismi has no idea what to do. She recalls from Binx's story that Almandine is the fairy whose tithe is touch. She's a known sensualist, just like Annette said, and yet, earlier the housemaid was talking about Almandine having changed since her visit to La Morte, muttering about giant-beaked vultures coming to consume us all. One thing is clear. Whatever happened up there in La Morte has destroyed Almandine, which means the fairy queen Malfleur is just as powerful and just as merciless as they have feared. As Almandine's coarse weeping turns back into a low, unsteady murmuring, Ismi steps away from her and hurries to the exit. She doesn't want to hear any more. She needs to find William and get out of here. But the fairy's words reach her even as she's fumbling for the door, and they slither around her like poisoned vines. "They're coming. They're coming. They're coming." 29. Aurora. The storm has lasted days, and Aurora has yet to fully understand what happened. The kiss that made its mark on her. Irremovable. Not exactly a wound, but something that she senses will never fully heal or disappear. Her whole body still aches from it. She finds she is trembling as she lies alone in her room, unable to sleep. And yet, she thought she'd know when true love happened, like she told Heath. But there are no answers, only more questions, more unfulfilled yearnings, more fears. In one instance, though, the truth has crystallized. She was 13, Ismi 15. It was raining then, too. Aurora was going through a phase of always wanting to dress her older sister up, encourage her to look and act more like a princess and less like a ruffian who happened to stumble into the palace on a stray wind. Ismi, of course, couldn't have been less interested, but that didn't stop Aurora from trying. Lately, Aurora had come to see her sister as the object of an unfolding romance, and the thought fascinated her to no end. This had come about largely due to the secret love letters they had discovered in a cracked stone just outside Isby's bedroom wall, and which Aurora had read and interpreted to Isby. They were never addressed to a particular person, and they weren't signed either. The mystery lit Aurora on fire. Isby, being blind, could not read, nor could most women in the palace. Aurora was an exception. Without a voice, she was left with long hours during which she taught herself the alphabet and a vocabulary of which she was very proud. As for the men, it was likely that only one of highborn blood had the skill of penmanship to write these secret letters. Several distant but not unattractive dignitaries had been visiting court for the past month, and Aurora knew it had to be one of them. Isby, predictably, denied the notion that any of the young men might have noticed her favorably, but it was the only explanation, and Aurora was both terrified and thrilled. What would happen if someone asked for her sister's hand in marriage? Would they be separated? She had once longed for the romantic drama to unfold and ached for things to remain the same forever. On this one particular rainy morning, Aurora had uncovered a chest in a seldom-used visiting room in the West Hall, containing lavishly embroidered hennins with long flowing veils, bejeweled buckles, and sumptuous surcoats lined in ermine and fox, much of which had belonged to her mother, Queen Amelie. The council had ordered most of the Queen's personal furnishings and possessions burned a year prior, in an effort to ward off a return of the plague that killed her. But that didn't scare Aurora. She was thrilled to discover that something of her mother's had remained intact. It was a touchy subject between the sisters. When the Queen was alive, she had made it no secret that she resented Isby's presence, a constant reminder of the King's earlier dalliances. But Aurora always felt they would have learned to love each other, had each given the other a chance. She mourned not only the loss of her mother, but the missed chance for Isby to see her as she had. Still, belonging to the Queen or not, these garments would be perfect for Isby to try on. Perhaps Aurora might even convince her to parade in them through the quarters where the youngest of the dignitaries was staying. With one of the sapphire-studded tiaras still in her hand, Aurora dashed to Isby's room to share the exciting news, shoving open the door without knocking. The sisters never knocked. More often than not, they came through the hidden passageway connecting their bedrooms. She entered and dropped the tiara in surprise. It fell to the floor with a loud clatter. Isby was not in her room, but Gilbert was. He turned at the sound and blushed deeply. He'd gone through his growth spurt only recently and didn't yet seem to own the breadth of his shoulders. His red hair was matted and wet with rain. He'd clearly climbed in through the window, which was still open. In his hand was a folded piece of thin vellum. Aurora stared. He couldn't be. Gil couldn't even write, let alone afford vellum and ink. Besides, Aurora knew the two of them had become very close, but only as friends. Her sister would never entertain the affections of a stable boy, would she? It didn't make any sense. Aurora, Gil said quietly. She cocked her head at him. Her expression must have been all too plain. What are you doing? Please, don't tell. He rushed one hand through his dripping hair. Aurora's forehead crinkled. I know. She can't even read them. I realize how ridiculous it seems. I never meant for her to read them anyway. Not really. I have no hope that... Aurora still stared, confused. Rule helped me find a courier to write them out for me. Disappointment settled into her like a low cloud, dampening all her amorous fantasies. So Isby had been right. There was no foreign dignitary madly in love with her. There was no secret paramour. There was just Gilbert, the stable boy. Indignation trumped disappointment. How dare he risk the injury of her sister's heart? How dare he crush Isby's hopes? Though even as she asked herself, she knew that she, and not Isby, was the one crushed, not by the dashed dream of love, but by the unpleasantly ordinary end to the grand story she'd been concocting in her head. And though she couldn't speak, her body language as she slammed open the door and held it wide for Gilbert said everything. Get out. He hurried away and Aurora seethed. vowing not to tell Isby what she had learned, hoping that by keeping it a secret, she was in some way keeping safe the belief that one day her sister would find true love, that true love did exist. As the night fire burns down to embers in a corner of her tower room, sending up tufts of smoke as rain filters in from the chimney, Aurora realizes her error, over and over, like the echoing gong of a bell. Gilbert helped Isby escape in the dead of winter when the council meant to send her away. He is likely with her sister even now. He has always watched out for her when Aurora could not. It is suddenly clear as polished crystal to Aurora. Gilbert is, and always has been, in love with Isby. And Aurora, in expressing her silent disapproval on that embarrassing day 3 years ago, is likely the reason he never since acted on those feelings. Though the dashing paramour of Aurora's 13-year-old imagination had never existed, someone did pine for her sister, did spend time and hard-earned money writing his feelings down on vellum, with no expectation of a return of affection. There was no fantasy, just a real-life boy. Aurora had been naive then, but she isn't any more, and she knows too, has known since seeing the servant girl's aghast face in the gallery, that Wren is in love with Heath. But she hasn't said anything. She has held the truth close to her like a love letter that's never meant to be read. Heath told her he didn't believe in true love, that he never really felt he had a choice before. Now Aurora can't help but wonder whether, if circumstances were different, he'd choose her. That's nonsense, she reminds herself. She can't be with Heath. She's a princess and her kingdom needs her. She must return home to marry the third prince of Arben. But this fact no longer remains a fixed point in her mind. Like a firefly, when she tries to look directly at the truth, tries to reach for it, its glow blinks out, allowing the idea to swim, mysteriously away, lighter than air. Home is not the thing she longs for. Home is a kind of death now, a coffin walled on all sides to which she must resign herself forever. For surely her fairy tithes will hold in the real world. She will no longer have her voice. She will no longer feel. She will have to release the fantasy of, maybe almost, falling in love with Heath. But how can she stay? Sommei is dying, starving. Aurora has probably broken the heart of the one girl here who has shown her the most kindness and support. And Heath himself has confessed that he wants to believe in love. But wanting to is not the same as believing. In truth, he has given Aurora no promise at all of his feelings or intentions. And then there's the Queen, waiting forever for the impossible return of someone she loves, of Charles Blackthorne, Aurora's almost sure to set her free. But that can't be the full story, Aurora realizes as she sits up in bed, her long hair tangled all around her shoulders. What is she missing? Something must have come between Charles and Belle Kerr. Or someone. 30. Vulture, a soldier in Malfleur's army. From where the Lamorte army stands, forming battalion after battalion of muscle and iron on the precipice of Mount Briar, Deluce's palace looks like a tiny oil painting that's been left in the rain. The fog surrounding it appears quaint, like a lady's skirt. A lady they are going to ravage and make theirs. For a moment, Vulture hears a whisper on the wind, a horse's quiet snuffle, and it makes him remember what it felt like to be an I and not a we. What it felt like to see from all sides of his eyes instead of through tight black holes. He turns his beak-like mask to the left and sees the rest of them. The Queen calls all of them Vulture. They are no longer individuals, but one dark mass of masks and black cloaks, of heavy armor and impenetrable eyes. Malfleur paces along the cliff, counting off, conveying instructions. She approaches Vulture, but keeps walking without any acknowledgement. The Queen has forgotten him. She has forgotten that Vulture, this Vulture, is special. She had required a talented groom, a skilled rider, someone familiar with destriers and coursers, their behavior, the shape of their long noses. It was he, Vulture, this Vulture, who was asked to design the terrifying silver muzzles worn by all of her warhorses. They wear the beaks for protection from the sickness, which is not, he now understands, her doing. Though what terrible magic created it, he cannot say. But the masks do more than just block the disease. They narrow the focus. They separate the man from the world he is riding into, from the victim he must either gain command over or kill. And there is something deeply reassuring about the darkness within the mask. Vulture can sink back into it like a boundless sea, can let go of almost everything that once made him who he was and weighed him down. All that's left of before is a faint twinge. The rest is black ocean, is night sky, is anger, is flight. But that twinge persists. A tiny spark within him that makes him want to go back, to flee the oil vessel in one of the smaller dinghies and look for her, rescue her, or risk death in the vast, real ocean trying, rather than stay and face the mercenaries who bound him, who threatened him, who gave him no choice, who turned him into what he is now, into one of them. Vulture. As Malfleur passes him by, he catches a glance of her glossy dark hair, lifted and wild in the breeze, and he sees not the queen, but her. Her, falling backward into the waves alone. Her, laughing, rebuking, arguing, rallying, racing through fields on a mare's bare back. Her, throwing her hands up to his face to feel what he felt, to change him, to leave her mark on him. But it is pointless, he knows, to think of her. For what would Isabel say if she saw him now? Part 5. Before Break of Morn. 31. Isabel. It's strange to draw near the castle village where she spent her entire life growing up. Isby thought she would find its familiarity reassuring after their arduous journey. Instead, when William shouts to her that he can see the towers and the drawbridge in the distance, she is overcome with a distinct and uncomfortable sensation of slipping into an old, tight shoe. The smell also reminds her of old shoes, though she has come to realize that it is in fact the odor of death. Along the road leading here, completely abandoned by travelers, she and William have stumbled upon the rotting carcasses of crows who dropped from the sky having succumbed to the sickness, presumably after feasting on sleeping mice. Even now, William points out another one wobbling awkwardly through the blue dawn, and a moment later she hears it plummet to the ground with a disturbing thud. Isby grimaces. "What else do you see?" she asks, grateful that he's at least speaking to her again. After a few icy hours, his edges seem to have melted a little. William breathes slowly beside her. "Vines," he says. "Giant flowers. Purple, lush, like big yawning mouths. Collars of thorns all around them. Vines on the castle walls, vines on the trees and road. An overturned carriage almost entirely covered in them." Vines. Of course they'd heard about them before, but she's reminded of something now. "William," she says, touching his elbow, "Almandine spoke of vines when she was talking about Queen Malfleur. She said something about the Queen's jealousy of Belcur, because Belcur could tame the vines. Pestilent vines, she said. Belcur could turn them into beautiful flowers."
"Belcur was killed long ago."
"That's another thing. Almandine said Belcur was some place called Samay. Something terrible happened between the two sisters, and now Belcur would never return. Maybe Malfleur didn't slay her. What if the stories and lullabies are wrong?" She remembers, too, the other version of the rose lullaby, the one she sometimes hears in her mother dreams, the one in which the twin fairies play together until nightfall, and no slaying is mentioned at all.
"What if they are?" William asks. "Does it change our mission at all?"
"I'm just thinking.
What if Belcur is back and these terrible, beautiful flowers are her doing?
Then we have an even greater foe than we thought, William concedes. But I still don't see how this changes our plans for the Alliance, he says Alliance, like the word is made out of a cold foreign metal.
Maybe it doesn't, Isby agrees. She scrunches her brow, thinking. What was Belcur's tithe? The nature of her magic?
She wishes Aurora were beside her. Her sister has all the fairy histories practically memorized.
I don't know much about the fae. There's another one. Moments later, Isby hears yet another crow fall from the sky.
She shudders. What are you doing?
William has stopped walking, and it sounds like he is squatting down.
There's something in its mouth, he says by way of explanation.
Be careful. It carries the disease. It could spread.
The sickness has become all too real. She keeps thinking any moment she'll feel a yawn coming on, and it'll be the first sign of the end, or worse, that William will drop to the ground beside her.
There's something in its beak, William says, investigating. Like blood. But it's black. No, it's purple.
Do you think...
I don't know, but I don't like it. Let's keep going.
They don't get much farther before she notices something cutting through the smell of death. Saffron, clothes, pepper.
Spices, Isby says.
A merchant cart, like the one that drove her and Gilbert to the harbour. It's both shocking and peculiarly comforting, the idea of people going about their trade even during such terrible times.
I thought the road was cordoned off. We haven't seen any other travellers for miles, William points out.
True. It's strange. But there can be little other explanation for such a combination of scents.
It is troubling, though. Why would a spice merchant be travelling this way? And why can she not hear the clop of hooves or clatter of his wagon?
Isabel, William says, grabbing her arm and causing her to halt in her tracks right as they are rounding a bend in the road.
Is it?
She starts.
You were right. A spice merchant.
He's... William lets out a sickened moan, and Isby has her answer. The merchant is dead.
She shouldn't be surprised. They've passed bodies frozen, and even carcasses ravaged by animals from the forest.
But somehow this injury, among the list of distresses they've had, stings. Could this be the very man who Binks sent to help them not so long ago?
She recalls that Gil described the man's face as hideously malformed, though he hid it behind some sort of mask worn to manage the overpowering scent of all the spices.
William, can you describe what he looks like?
Why do you want to know?
I may have met him before.
She feels her voice breaking. She doesn't even know the man's name. It makes no sense, not when thousands are suffering, and the one person who has ever loved her may be dying.
When Gil is gone, possibly for good, and yet it pains her, this minor loss in the grand scheme of things.
She hears William suck in a disgusted breath and then hold it. A moment later he returns to her side.
His wares are scattered in the road, a rainbow of coloured dusts. The man is on his side, no beard. His face sort of swollen. His jowls look like a few clumps of clay that have been mashed together.
So it is him. It has to be.
Is he wearing a sort of mask?
It looks like he was wearing one, but it is down around his neck, like a fat noose.
She tenses. There must have been a struggle, or he had trouble breathing. Something to have caused the mask to be ripped off in a hurry.
How he even got this far from the palace is a wonder,
William comments, echoing her own thoughts. How could he have gotten this far before succumbing, like the others who've gone to the Delusian castle and never returned?
Perhaps he knew something, some way of avoiding the disease, but then it caught up to him,
Isby ponders.
I am worried, William. I know we must advance, but are we walking straight into our doom?
She feels the tension in his hand, still on her arm. Her throat gets tight. It isn't just the fear of the disease that gives her pause. If she's honest with herself, it's a conversation they had while in the steam room, deep in the cellars of Almondine's estate. Or better put, the conversation they haven't had since. She still doesn't know what he's thinking. If he regrets his proposal. More importantly, she doesn't know how she feels. Thoughts of that awkward moment have been torturing her non-stop since they fled the mansion.
Should we keep going? William asks, his voice soft. The decision is yours. I will respect whatever you choose to do.
Whatever she chooses. But what are her options? They could still back away. They could find their way to Rules in the hope that Gilbert had returned there safely. She could hide out among the peasants as they await Malfleur's invasion. And then what? Watch as he and his children are strung up to die or conscripted into the Fairy Queen's army? Sit back while her kingdom is taken? No. If she's going to die, she'll die having done the right thing. She'll die next to her sister.
I used to sneak off with a mare called Freckles, Isby says carefully. No one likes to ride her because she's unruly. Impossible. She never listens. But the way she runs.
Gil, my best friend, Gilbert, she pauses. This is the first time she's ever mentioned Gil's existence to the prince, and saying his name aloud rattles her.
He calls the mare a bad mover, she goes on. But it's not true. She just has her own rhythm. And William, she can go so fast.
The memory rushes through her.
When we were tearing through woods and fields together, not far from this very spot, I felt like I was really alive. I felt like nothing we'd left behind mattered anymore. I didn't have to know where we were headed. What was important was that we were flying head first, like an arrow. Nothing could stop us. I never let go until she threw me.
And has she thrown you now? William asks quietly.
No,
she answers, hard and resolute.
No, she is not.
All right then, he says calmly. Let's go.
He heads forward down the road.
Careful of that wheel, it came loose. Here you go.
He helps her pass the wreckage of the spice merchant's cart, and as he does, he lets out a huge sputtering sneeze. It's a ridiculous sound coming from so commanding and serious a person. Despite everything, she laughs. In a sharp inhale, all the pepper and ginger in the air rises up her nostrils and she begins coughing and sneezing too.
No wonder he needed a mask, the prince says, catching his breath.
Yes, no wonder.
If only a mask could protect us from the sleeping sickness, William muses.
Hmm,
Isby replies.
A mask? Yes, a mask! A mask!
She stops walking and smacks him in the arm. William, you're brilliant!
Are you mocking me?
No!
The sincerity of his question, the hurt in it, sends a shock through her. He's still upset over the proposal, over her rejection, because that's what it was, she realizes.
Despite what you might think of me now, I'm not callous. I think I have a theory on the sickness. What if the spice merchant made it this far from the castle because of his mask? It protected him somehow, but when he removed it, he died.
So you think the disease is airborne then, William says, like the scent of his spices?
Right, perhaps.
Maybe carried by the breath of the birds. That could explain the crow's purple tongue, I suppose.
The purple tongue? No, I have a better theory. It's...
The vines, they say simultaneously. Smelling them, he says.
Or eating them, in the case of the birds, Isby adds. And then after a pause, it's fairy magic. Either the work of Malfleur, or, more likely, her not actually dead sister, Belle Kerr. The vines carry a pestilence. Like Almandine said, some sort of poison that puts all creatures who come into contact with their scent to sleep. It explains the presence of the vines, all those flowers you described, and it explains the merchant and the birds falling asleep mid-flight.
William, it really is brilliant. I didn't come up with it, Isabel. You did. You're the brilliant one.
Why does it feel like you're mocking me now?
His voice is somber and a little quiet when he replies,
I'm not.
She shivers. No one has ever told her she was brilliant, but there's something about the way William talks. He makes her feel that everything she says and does matters. That he's always listening, always aware of her. That he cares, on some fundamental level, about her thoughts and her feelings and her actions and about her. Yes, he cares about her. There is no questioning it. Suddenly she is very, very warm.
It's worth a try, isn't it?
She says, trying to keep the smile off her face. For the first time since she heard Binx's tale, she feels driven by something other than a wild, stubborn determination. She is startled to name that thing. Hope.
Not more than an hour later, Isby steps cautiously into the suffocating quiet of the palace courtyard, with William right beside her. Thick swathes of brocaded fabric from his cloak tied in layers around their mouths and noses. The formerly bustling courtyard is now as still and cold as a tomb. Without her sense of smell, Isby is doubly alert to the stillness, a fuzzy silence like the pause between snores. Even though she can't detect the signature briny odor of the strait, she can sense its proximity by the salty dampness on her skin. And then, all at once, a powerful feeling of homecoming floods through her. She lets go of William's arm and begins to run. Isby pushes her way through closed doors and down eerily abandoned corridors. She nearly tumbles over the bodies of courtiers, some sleeping and some, she fears, already dead. She can't think about that just yet. She is home. She is home. She is home. She bounds up the stairs, 20 to the landing and then 4 more to the door of her sister's bower. She hears William following a few paces behind. And then she is inside Aurora's room, and then, in an instant, beside her bed, feeling along the neatly made bedspread until she gasps, her hands coming upon her sister's, which are cold, too cold. She leans forward, her heart racing, and touches Aurora's forehead. Her hair is strewn over the pillows. Someone must have carried her up here. She moves her hands to Aurora's chest and can only make out the slightest rise and fall. She gasps hard in relief, nearly choking on the heavy fabric around her face. It seems as though the sleeping sickness has somehow preserved Aurora in this state. She's alive, though deathly thin. She's alive and...
"We've made it!" she bursts out. "William! William, come here! This is her! This is her! Aurora!"
Tears sting her eyes. She finds she is shaking, torn between breaking into hysterical laughter and falling to the floor, exhausted. It is hard to breathe, hard to think. She's back, and Aurora is alive. Everything is going to be all right. They're together again. William comes over to her, kneeling down by the bed and wrapping one arm around Isby. Without thinking, she gives in to his slight pull, leaning against his side, trying to slow her breath, wishing she could rip off her mask and laugh, shout, kiss him. No. Quickly, she banishes the last idea from her mind. For several moments, both of them just sit there like that, facing Aurora's sleeping form, saying nothing. And then she feels him take a deep breath, and when he lets it out, he says, "My future wife." The words echo through the room like marbles scattered from a jar. Isby says nothing. She says nothing and says nothing, and then says more nothing. Minutes tick by until she's convinced that they too have caught the sickness and that it is gradually numbing their throats and minds. Finally, she steels herself, stepping back into the role she has always played, the invisible armor she has had to wear every day of her life just before entering the dining hall to meet the critical gaze of her stepmother, or undergoing another lecture by the council, or hunching beneath the blow of an angry kitchen wench's metal pot. And then, invisible armor in place, she takes that cumbersome, weighty, ever-expanding nothing and turns it into something. "Kiss her," she commands, her chest made of iron. "It's time." William doesn't respond. He doesn't, to her relief, or dismay, or incomprehensible regret, resist. She holds her breath. She holds everything back, every single feeling and thought shoved into a dark cove at the very heart of her, other than one. Wake up. Wake up, wake up, wake up. William leans over the bed. He lifts his mask almost silently. He hesitates one more moment and then... "Isabel," he whispers. She realizes she's been frozen. She's not sure for how long.
"Yes,"
she whispers back.
"It's not working."
"What do you mean it's not working?"
"I kissed her. She hasn't stirred." Did you really think she would?"
Fury flies up Isby's spine.
"You aren't doing it right. You must love her. It's the kiss of true love. It's... she believed in it. It's... it can't be any other way."
Her throat burns. Her lungs are on fire. She's going to be sick.
"You are her destined husband," Isby insists desperately. "And it's Aurora. She's so beautiful. She's so perfect.
Isby shudders, her voice breaking like shattered glass. Anger sparks and then gutters into shame. Dismay, confusion. How can it not work? It has to work, not for any logical reason, but by sheer dint of her needing it to, of wishing it so. But wishing never got anyone anywhere.
I'm sorry, he murmurs,
and his now familiar, rustling leaves voice blows through her with chilly certainty.
It didn't work. Aurora is still asleep.
32. Aurora. Aurora drags a heavy axe through the quiet of the sleeping castle, dew still clinging to the hem of her dress. The morning fields had opened before her like a series of yawns, great mouths watering with hunger, and she'd allowed them to swallow her for hours as she wandered, searching. Since a necklace of pearls and rubies now lay scattered throughout the borderlands, she'd need something else, she knew, something powerful, stronger than the rose lullaby. An object from the real world that could break through the queen's illusions once and for all. And then she remembered the story Heath had told her, of the soldiers who first tried to break out of Blackthorn, one of them successfully forming a rift in the wall with an axe. And so she'd scoured the estate, finally coming upon a store of tools. This axe had stood out to her as different from the others. A complex design decorated the stone head. The wood of the handle was weathered and old. It felt firm in her hands, definite, unlike so many other objects in Somay, which seemed to give just slightly when held, to take on some flavor of the person who had touched them. As she passes through each of the now familiar rooms and halls of Blackthorn, Aurora reminds herself that this might be the last time she sees them. She knows what she must do. She must make Belle Kerr remember. She must make her realize that Charles is never going to come, and that jealousy has eroded her mind. If the Queen can let go of her jealousy, she can let go of her dreams and move on. She can set Aurora free. Set all of them free. Though Aurora isn't certain who came between Charles Blackthorn and Belle Kerr, she has a good guess. After all, she knows something about jealous sisters. Wasn't it the last thing she said to Isby before her own sister fled? Don't be jealous of me. Aurora knows the unfairness of life better than anyone. Some are born princesses, some bastards. That is how the world has always worked and will always work. Those who are born blessed will be the envy of those who are not. The musty scent of the corridor leading to the North Hall clings to Aurora's senses, filling her with sadness. She feels draped in its longing like a physical weight, its stickiness like a spider's web that wants to pull her back, back, back. The walls whisper, "Stay." They throb, "Don't hurt us," they seem to say. But sometimes pain is the only way. She reaches the North Hall and the door that only recently had opened elegantly before her, inviting her closer to the Queen's lair. Once again, however, the door is locked. The knob is cold and hard as bone. The castle is so quiet she can hear her breath loud in her ears. "Don't hurt us. Stay." Aurora's arms pulse from the weight of the axe. She lifts it over her head, and then she swings it down. A loud crick-crack ripples through the air as the stone axe head meets the wooden door, splintering it. Pound, pound, swack. It takes several swings, and with each, the door shudders, cries, cracks further, and Aurora could swear she feels how it wants to heal itself closed, keeping her out. The splintering wood seems to sigh a final stop. She swings again, throwing all of her strength into it. Finally, the door collapses. Her hands are raw, her back is strained and tight, her arms feel like lead. She grabs a lit torch from a sconce and steps inside, the hall of tapestries, the den of fog. Finding her way around the wing doesn't prove easy, though. There are doorways that cut right in the middle of walls that lead to twisting tunnels, each impenetrably dark, studded with mouse droppings and the occasional chilling sound of scratching or whimpering. Aurora soon finds herself disoriented. It's not just the winding passageways of the Forbidden Wing that have her so turned around. She has the distinct impression that the chambers have all stood up,
and rearrange themselves every time she emerges into a new room, like an endless maze. And then she recalls that her own palace used to have many of these tunnels before they were blocked with plaster, all but the one connecting her room to Isby's. Yes. As quickly as the thought comes to her, she is able to slide back a wall hanging and enter another passageway, one sloped steeply upward and uncomfortably familiar. Aurora lets out the breath she didn't know she was holding as she bursts out the other side into a tower bedroom that looks very much like her own at home. She takes in the neatly made bed with its drooping lace canopy, the gilt mirror and the vanity with a hairbrush lying on it, the half-woven tapestry stretched across a loom in one corner. The room is empty but filling with the same dark fog that has followed her this far. At the foot of the bed is a trunk. She kneels before it and throws open its lid. She braces herself for more horrors, bugs or rodents or even decayed bones. But instead, she finds only a heap of objects that appear to be the Queen's private treasures. Across the inside of the curved lid, words have been scratched into the wood. Everyone deserves true love. The message sends an odd jolt down Aurora's spine. There's a rotting wedding veil, and beneath it, several old, nearly hairless dolls. Below those lie a small, flat rectangle of wood. She picks it up and turns it over. On the other side is a portrait of two little girls. Their faces look very alike, though one is sharper somehow, and has darker hair. Marigold. The sister with the lighter hair is holding a daisy and smiling, while Marigold is looking somewhere past the portrait artist's position. Understanding cascades through Aurora. Marigold is an impression of Mal Fleur as a child, one created by Bal Kerr, whom her sister called Daisy. The painting, and Marigold's existence at all, indicate that Bal Kerr cared deeply about her twin, despite what the stories would have had Aurora believe. She sets down the portrait and looks at the bottom of the chest, which is covered in a dark, rusty stain. She knows what it is. Blood. Stop! Aurora turns around to see not Bal Kerr, but Wren, standing in the doorway, wringing her hands. I have to do this, she says to the girl. Her voice floats out of her with an authority that surprises her. I have to confront the Queen. No, you don't. You could just leave it, leave us. Wren's voice has a slight warble to it, like it could break. You've done enough damage! They stand facing each other in the dark bedroom. That's just it. I need to fix this. I need to go home. Aurora keeps her mind and her words focused on those truths. But what about Heath? Wren asks. Aurora shakes her head, willing the tears not to fall. Please forgive me, she says. I never meant for. I didn't know. Please don't be jealous of me. Jealous of you? Because of the kiss? Because you... Aurora! Wren folds her arms across her chest. I know Heath better than anyone. Certainly better than you. I know him. I know what he's like. He hasn't chosen you, and he never will. Her calm tone sends a shiver up Aurora's spine. But... You love him, Aurora says quietly, her heart still aching for the girl and for herself and for the impossibility of the true love in which she once believed. Love, Wren replies, does not have room for jealousy. It is just a thing, you know, a part of who you are forever. It's inalterable. But he kissed me, Aurora sputters, and it's more than just that. I know it is. I can feel that it's more. It's just like what happened to the Queen, Wren cocks her head. What do you mean? Bal Kerr loved Charles Blackthorne, but I think he fell for her sister, Mal Fleur. That's why Bal Kerr made Samae and retreated into her world of dreams. She didn't want to have to face a life without true love, Aurora says, telling the story as if it's one she's read a thousand times in her library. Her jealousy is what destroyed her. You have it all wrong, says a raspy voice. Both Aurora and Wren go silent. Wren pushes her way into the room beside Aurora as they both peer through the haze. The Queen now sits at the loom on the far side of the room. Aurora can't be sure how long the woman has been there, her loom softly click-clacking as she listens to their argument. It's even harder to see now. The windows are blackening, another illusion, Aurora thinks. Ren turns to Aurora and then back to the Queen, clearly awed. Aurora can't believe that the girl, that all the residents of Blackthorn, have lived their entire lives right beside the Mad Queen and have never once laid eyes on her. It's crazy to think that they've been so close to a way out all this time, but have never known it. Then again, she realizes, perhaps everyone has the key to her own prison. Maybe freedom is just a matter of knowing the right story, of being brave enough to say the right words, in the right order, at the right time. The old woman leans over her loom, and for a moment, Aurora thinks she is weaving her own silver-white hair into the tapestry. She doesn't look up, but shakes her head slightly.
"My queen,"
Ren whispers, trying to wave away the haze.
"What do we have wrong?"
The queen sighs.
"I was never the jealous one. It was my sister who envied me."
Aurora and Ren step closer until Aurora can see the tears on the queen's face, even in the stifling dimness of the room.
"Then why are you crying?"
Aurora asks gently, as though too harsh a demand might make the woman dissolve into the thick air.
"Because there's nothing sadder than someone leaving," the queen says, her voice almost childlike. "Who left you? Was it Charles Blackthorn?"
"Aurora," Ren cautions.
"Be careful. She'll trick us."
Belcur shakes her head.
"She left. She left. But not again. Not this time. I won't be left alone. Again."
"She?" Aurora steps closer. It's getting harder to breathe in here. No matter how her eyes adjust, the air only grows thicker and blacker. Could the queen be talking about her sister? Is it possible she's been waiting all this time, not for her true love, but for Malfleur herself? The queen looks up, her eyes ablaze with swirling greens and blues.
"I won't be left alone again."
"Aurora," Ren says, beginning to cough.
"Run!"
Aurora feels a tug on her sleeve, but she can't move. She's fixed to the spot, staring at the loom.
"No one will leave me,"
Belcur says. Aurora is riveted not by her words, but by the breathtaking beauty of the tapestry the queen has been weaving all this time. A forest dash with streaks of red and yellow and orange that leap toward a blackened sky. Flames. 33. Belcur, the Night Fairy. There is screaming as the residents of Blackthorn wake up to the thick clouds of ash floating over the walls of the borderlands toward the castle. The forest is on fire. The queen sees the two girls' bodies outlined in plumes of dark smoke as they try to run from here, run from her. She reaches out, clinging to the visitor's skirt. They hate her, and she deserves to be hated, to be loathed, to be left.
"I'm sorry," she croaks quietly, though the visitor can't hear her.
She chokes on the smoke.
"I'm sorry,"
she repeats, falling to the floor as she continues to cling to the young woman's dress, holding her back. Those two words unleash a flood of memories, suppressed for so long they make her sick with dizziness. For she is sorry, always has been. She's been sorry since she was 7 years old, and her parents gifted her the enormous golden wheel from a distant eastern country, one that, with just a little magic, could not only spin wool into yarn, but gold and silver into thread, and too, she learned, dreams. But that would come later. Sorry, because her sister was unhappy that the spinning wheel had gone to her. Malfleur would stare at Belcur's fingers, their agility as they danced by the rapid flyer, never once getting pricked by the sharp-ended bobbin, and Belcur could feel the unhappiness in her dark gaze. Belcur had never wanted to compete, had never believed her magic was in any way stronger than her twins. There was an ease to it. True, it came to her naturally. She never studied as Malfleur did. She never practiced. As a consequence, her magic was softer around the edges. It never quite felt like it was in her control, and she didn't mind that. But her twin did. Though Malfleur never outright accused her, she must have held Belcur to blame when they discovered at a very young age that Malfleur simply couldn't dream. While Belcur experienced lustrously imagined, richly vivid sequences of memory, emotion and sensation when she slept each night, Melfleur sank only into an infinite blank. It didn't take long for their parents to conclude that Belcur's gift, her desire, the source of all her magic, had to do with dreaming. Even without learning how to perform a tithing, Belcur had somehow absorbed her twin's ability to dream while they were tangled together within their mother's womb. She had tried to make it up to Melfleur in so many ways over the years. Sometimes it felt like all she ever did was compensate for this original sin. She spun nothing with as much love as a thread she used to weave garments for her sister. And when Melfleur was caught causing mischief and sent to bed without any supper, Belcur always slipped her food from her own plate. There were times when she simply couldn't protect her sister, though. She'll never forget the day they snuck out to collect flowers for their mother's birthday tea party. Melfleur had wanted to find violets, their mother's favorite, but they didn't grow in the gardens, and she had gotten lost wandering into the vast fields beyond the castle grounds. Belcur was forced to return alone to their mother, who was worried and upset beyond belief. Her tea party had been ruined, left out cold and untouched, while she sent a search party to find Melfleur. When they finally brought Melfleur home, Belcur, in her effort to make everything better, brewed her mother a fresh pot of tea, hoping they could start over and salvage the day, but by then their mother's distress had picked up speed like a summer storm and morphed into fury. Their mother, cruel as ever, grabbed the gilt cup from Belcur's tray and splashed still-scalding tea into Malfleur's face to teach her never to wander again. A white scar remained across her sister's eyelid and cheek, and that's when a stain of darkness, Belcur is sure, began to settle into her sister's heart. Still, Belcur continued to accept the blame for her sister's misdeeds as often as she convincingly could. She even came to enjoy taking her sister's place in the punishment chair, positioned in the corner of the parlor room in their summer cottage. Her sister, during the many hours she spent supposedly atoning for the trouble she'd made, would scratch clever limericks and poems into the wall there. It became a secret way for the girls to communicate, for Belcur to read and decipher the messages, and to feel like she was a part of Malfleur's world, even as her sister increasingly snuck away without telling her. It hurt. The idea of Melfleur keeping secrets. Belcur wanted more than anything to be her twin's confidant. And so she was delighted by little phrases such as, "The secret boy, we almost kissed, he won my jewel in a game of whist." Belcur guessed what her sister was referring to. The night Melfleur had borrowed their mother's pearl necklace and slipped silently out of the guest quarters at Blackthorn to play cards with the older visitors. It was only a couple years later, and after several more visits with the Blackthorns, both at their castle and at hers, that Belcur began to suspect just which boy Melfleur had almost kissed. It was Charles Blackthorn himself, and she could see he was smitten with her by the way he seemed especially attuned to Malfleur's tenor of sarcasm, was always ready with a reply and a twinkling gaze that seemed to suggest a wink, even where there wasn't one. When Belcur questioned her sister about her budding romance with Charles, Melfleur always brushed it off as a flirtation. But Belcur could see what her sister would not admit, that the bubbling, exciting, yearning intensity between them was mutual. They had some sort of understanding that much was clear, even when, at 16, Melfleur left their father's lands to learn more about her magic and travelled for 3 years abroad, without offering Charles any overt promise of her affections. He would wait. That was what everyone thought. Though Belcur missed her sister terribly during those 3 years, she took pleasure in receiving the packages Melfleur regularly sent home to her, precious knick-knacks and odd inventions from all around the world, like a clock with a bird's face that popped out to chime the hour, a beautiful birdcage, a delicate silver teapot, a hairbrush, and a filigreed hand mirror. She was surprised when Charles began to come around more frequently, at first to compare letters from Malfleur's travels and to marvel at the gifts she'd sent, but then, more and more often, he visited simply to talk, and the more he spoke, the more he let slip. He confessed that he had proposed to Malfleur, and she had rejected him outright. Though she continued to send him letters, she'd made it clear that she was more interested in her own magic than in him. And besides, Melfleur was fond of reminding him that the Fae frequently outlived humans by whole lifetimes or more. Belcur could see he was devastated by her sister's refusal, which is why she did what she was always doing, whether for her sister or for her mother or, in this case, Charles. She offered sweetness and consolation in uncountable small ways, and in performing these modest acts of love, she grew to inhabit that love. She fell for Charles, his broad chest and perfect posture, his light brown hair cropped at the shoulders and almost always a bit disheveled from his latest ride, the thin beard he had newly grown, emphasizing the squareness of his jaw, the modest, simple crown he wore, a circlet of gold with no jewels. But more than these things, she loved the way he reminded her of Malfleur, his quick wit, his fiery laugh, his fiercely perceptive gaze. She didn't mean to fall, and certainly didn't expect any reciprocity. But, same as her magic, love blossomed easily and naturally. It was beyond her control. She was helpless to stop the feeling from growing and expanding until it got to the point where the spiky, poisonous vines that often choked the trees in the royal forest would spontaneously sprout purple flowers as she walked over them. And so it was that on the day Malfleur was to return from her travels, Charles found Belcur alone, head bent over a gift she was making for her twin, a dress woven from gold. It was July, so she was at the summer cottage on the outskirts of the royal forest, which afforded their father better hunting, and the blackthorns were visiting. Having changed her mind several times about the style of the sleeves, anxious to get the dress just right, Belcur realized she had run out of gold thread. She had just rethreaded the bobbin and begun to tap the foot pedal, causing the great wheel to spin. As usual, she became lost in the sparkling whir of the metallic filaments through her fingers, and hardly noticed a shadow cast into the room until she heard a quiet cough and looked up. Charles Blackthorn was standing in the doorway. "I could watch you work all day," he said, and she flushed, feeling sick with the effort of not smiling more broadly, not letting her affection have its name. He was leaning against the doorframe in his riding gear, and he seemed to be concentrating very hard. "Are you all right?" she asked. "You seem perplexed." "Malfleur returns today," he said, as though the knowledge hadn't been tormenting her for days and nights, both with excitement and uncertainty. She desperately wanted everything to go back to the way it had been, but a voice inside her reminded her that the love between them had been fraying invisibly for years, like the frizzy hair of a much-held doll, and one day the bold truth would be revealed. Was all love like this, she fretted, a covering, a craft, a transient softness impossible to regrow once shed? Even as she clutched the imaginary doll harder, she wore it down to its porcelain bones. But all she said was, "Yes, as you can see, I'm hurrying to finish her homecoming gift."
"I do see," he said, casting his glance at the single-sleeved dress hanging over the side of the wardrobe, studying it with that same expression of consternation. "It is sure to look lovely on her," he added.
"Of course," she replied awkwardly, hating the dress instantly, and hating herself.
"Then again," he said, "it would be very beautiful on you."
And though he wasn't making eye contact with her, she understood. She panicked. She should beg him to stop talking, but she was frozen as he went on.
"All it would need is a veil, and it would make a suitable wedding gown. No, not suitable. Stunning."
That's when he finally lifted his eyes to hers. She shook, snagging her index finger on the tip of the bobbin. "Ow!" she cried, the end of the golden thread flying from her hands. He ran to her, both the desired and feared effect, and without her perceiving how it had happened, he was kneeling before her, clutching her hands, kissing the injured one, then the other. He turned her hands over and kissed the inside of each wrist, his lips against the tender skin there caused her to tremble again. "Stop," her mind shouted, but her heart leaped into her throat, and instead she breathed his name aloud. "Charles!" Tears ran down her cheeks, but she didn't have the will to pull her hands back and wipe them away. Though he was normally equipped with a variety of clever phrases and compelling arguments, he was silent now as he slipped one hand to her bent knee and one to her damp cheek, and then, pushing her long blonde hair out of her face, He took the kiss she had forbidden herself to imagine. His lips told the story of how true his love was, that it had not been all hers, but had been theirs for some time.